This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Before we get too far into this thing today, yes, we know it's not officially a recession. But still, a shrinking economy in the third quarter, and that doesn't even count the month of October? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It's the 30th of October today. And this might be a good time to point out that there is an economy out there that is entirely separate and apart from the financial crisis. As of today, that economy officially stinks. Today's report on third quarter gross domestic product coming up. And once again, the Federal Reserve is opening its cash drawer. Overseas applicants only this time, though, please. A distinct lack of cash brought the U.S. economy to a screeching halt last quarter. Gross domestic product fell 0.3% July through September. Economists had predicted an even bigger decline, but Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports the worst may be yet to come.
A rule of thumb in economics, two consecutive quarters of negative growth equals a recession. Today's announcement marks the first quarter, but Mesirow Financial's Diane Swank isn't waiting for the second.
There's really no question we're in a recession.
Today's data shows Americans reeled in their spending this summer by 3.1%, an annual rate that hasn't been matched since 1980. That's right before the U.S. plunged into one of its deepest recessions ever. Swank predicts GDP will shrivel tenfold next quarter.
The ground is moving underneath us, and what has been surprising is how quickly people have been also put out of their jobs.
The pink slips have been flying the past few weeks, everyone from American Express and Yahoo to Whirlpool and Time Magazine, not to mention the tens of thousands of jobs expected to disappear on Wall Street. Jay Bryson, a senior economist at Wachovia Corporation, says the labor market is quickly cratering.
Our guess is that by early part of next year, you'll see the unemployment rate at 7%, and it's probably going to top out probably close to 8%, which would be the highest since the early 1980s.
This recession may not be quite as severe as that early 80s meltdown, but Diane Swank says it won't be like the recession in 2001 either, where consumers rode out that economic storm by borrowing. Swank says that credit buffer isn't there this time around, and that means one bumpy ride. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Now that we all know the economy here is shrinking, it might come as some consolation to know the greenback is still going strong. Trouble is, everybody's hoarding what dollars they do have, so countries that need them to do business are coming up short. In response, the Federal Reserve has opened up dollar-denominated credit lines for a handful of key economies, Mexico, Brazil, South Korea, and Singapore, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
This may sound like a bailout, but currency experts say it's as good for us as it is for the countries involved. They make up about 10% of U.S. trade. The raw materials in the products we buy from them are often sold in dollars. So if dollars are unavailable, commerce comes to a halt, which causes all kinds of problems.
As they ran around and tried to scramble to get dollar credit, their currencies depreciated massively. So it was disrupting international business, harmful both to them and to us.
Michael Musa is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says there's another plus for the U.S., which benefits when other countries use dollars to conduct business.
we are by far the world's largest borrower. And one of the reasons why we're able to borrow on reasonably cheap terms is because the dollar has this dominant role in international finance.
The plan is not without risk. It depends on the four countries' ability to swap the dollars back in April. Jos Warsaw heads up global markets with Union Bank of California. He says if those countries' currencies depreciate further, that will be more difficult.
I mean, that's a risk to everything we're doing right now. And those risks are being weighed at the Fed, and they believe the alternative scenario poses a greater risk, and that's why these facilities have been put in place.
The Fed's move is also evidence of just how important these emerging markets have become and how vital the dollar remains. So when liquidity problems arise around the world, it's up to the Fed to deal with them. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
You want to know how big a deal AIG nearly going under was? At midnight tonight, Washington, D.C.'s public transit system could find itself owing foreign bankers $43 million. AIG guaranteed the D.C. Metro's deal and hundreds of others like it across the country. At least 31 public utilities and transit systems from Atlanta to L.A. might face similar defaults without ever having missed a debt payment. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
You never know how, in the midst of this financial crisis, complicated deals can come back and bite. Just take Washington Metro's decision to sell off more than $1 billion in trains to banks and finance companies over the last decade.
And the whole purpose of it was to get a tax write-off for the finance company or the bank.
Author and producer Hedrick Smith says back in the 1990s, banks around the world started buying up trains and sewers from cities and then leasing them back.
The city that was leasing its facilities got paid a fee, but it was all a financial gimmick.
Washington's Metro made a quick $100 million. But to make these deals fly, banks needed insurance that lease payments would be made on time. And that's where AIG came in. Carol Kessel is Washington Metro's CFO.
AIG, who is the primary guarantor for these transactions.
When AIG almost collapsed in September, the banks demanded years of lease payments all at once. Robert Healy at the American Public Transit Association says the effects are national.
We think that 31 transit systems would be hit around the country.
D.C.'s metro system may have to cough up $43 million by midnight, but it's on the hook for hundreds of millions in similar deals. Atlanta's metro could lose $400 million. Los Angeles' system could lose $300 million. And riders like John Cofrancesco wish that money could be used for something else.
How about new carriages so they're not disgusting? And how about they run on time and don't break down every single stop?
Well, we all can dream. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There was a noticeable absence of craziness on Wall Street today for a change, a relatively stable 2% gain all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Prime Minister of Iceland said today the banking crisis could wind up costing his country $9.5 billion, or 85% of the entire value of its economy. The government's trying to work out financing deals, so far without too much luck, save a $2 billion package from the International Monetary Fund. The IMF has been almost as busy as Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke have been as the U.S. credit crisis has gone global. Raghu Rajan is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago and a former chief economist at the IMF. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
So for years now, the IMF has kind of burbled along doing its thing in the global economy. And now all of a sudden with this crisis, it is front and center. What has happened that's made it so popular?
Well, we've had a crisis, and it's a global crisis. We've had small isolated crises before. In 1998, it was a big one. It was the Asian crisis. Since then, we've had a time of relative calm, so we haven't had to call the IMF that often. Now we find we really need them again.
Remind us, in a very short sentence or two, what the IMF was designed to do.
Well, it was set up towards the end of World War II, and the idea was to prevent the kind of bad policies that countries followed while trying to increase their own competitiveness at the expense of others. Typically, countries used to depreciate the exchange rate in an attempt to sell more than their neighbors, but then their neighbors followed suit, and this kind of activity led to the Great Depression.
And now, as you alluded to, a lot of people have gone knocking on the IMS door looking for money to get them through this crisis. How do you, as a guy who used to be the chief economist there, how do you choose who gets IMF assistance and who doesn't?
Well, you first look at the countries in need. Second, you look to see if they can have policies that will allow them to eventually be able to repay the loan. You're far more tolerant of them than the private markets are. That is why the IMF has a role. But also, you want to see that they will alter their policies so that eventually they will become fully capable of repaying the loan and reaccessing international financial markets.
Where is the IMF going to get this money, though, that it's going to have to hand out?
It's typically from the member countries themselves. Each country has a quota. It puts in money into the fund. There are also countries that are willing to lend to the fund on short notice, so it can get money from its members and lend them to members in need.
So there's no worries that the IMF might run out of money to be able to do all these rescues and bailouts that the whole economy seems to be doing?
Well, provided the member countries are willing to step up and increase how much they put into the fund, it is not going to run out of money. The real issue is how much is the fund willing to lend, how much is it willing to put at stake? Because it is possible that eventually countries get alarmed at the amount of money that's going out of the fund.
How do you figure out what's an appropriate amount to give?
Well, that will depend on how long and deep this crisis is. We've already had 15 to 20 billion to Ukraine. We have 25 billion to Hungary. So these things add up pretty quickly. Now, the good news is that it's not just the IMF which is lending here. There are other countries, there are other organizations that are following the lead of the IMF. The IMF is still is just the apex organization here. So it is possible to lend out a fair amount. But yes, at some point, we will start asking questions about the amounts that are going out.
Raghu Rajan at the Graduate School of Business at the University of Chicago, also a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Professor, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
With economic headlines scary enough to give Edgar Allan Poe something to write home about, we got to wondering whether the sense of dread in the financial world is permeating the culture at large. And if it is it going to show up tomorrow night on Halloween? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman went looking for people who've been spooked by the financial crisis and are dressing the part.
Some people don't want to wait for Halloween. A few weeks ago, 300 zombie bankers, brokers, and CEOs spewed out of a subway station near Wall Street. They massed on the steps of the old U.S. Customs House.
And then attacked the Wall Street bull, baptizing him in blood, and then ritually eating his brain.
Jim Glazer helps organize the group called Costume Cult. When he's not dressing up as a zombie, he's an executive recruiter. Costume Cult will march in tomorrow night's Greenwich Village Halloween parade. There'll be nearly naked short sellers and a troop of Wall Street apes in suits, ties, and monkey masks.
This year, the Wall Street apes will be apes down on their luck, and instead of rolled up Wall Street journals, they are going to be bringing their resumes with them.
These theatrics reflect something going on deep in the American psyche now that the boom has gone bust, says John McGarvey. He's an economics consultant.
The entire macroeconomic scenario has gotten into the hearts and wallets of the average citizen. So I think that's one reason why there's such an interest in financial costuming as a way to exercise those ghosts and fears and take ownership of them.
McGarvey's dressing up as your basic zombie banker this year, but at get-out-the-vote costume parties all over the country, folks are tackling higher concepts like John Bacino in Missoula and Jenna Byer and Jefferson Smith in Portland.
I'll be going as my 401k for Halloween this year, and I'll be printing off a copy of the graph to show exactly how poorly my 401k is done.
I just purchased an 80s power suit. I'm going to tear it up a little bit and then carry around a big check that says $700 billion with the name tag, Mrs. Lehman.
I've been going back and forth between being the bailout or being the invisible hand.
After Halloween, Jefferson Smith will become a very visible hand on the economy. He's running unopposed as a Democrat for a seat in the Oregon legislature next Tuesday. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Mitchell's put together a slideshow of those undead bankers and Wall Street zombies. Nothing to be afraid of. It's just Marketplace.org. Coming up, high stakes theft on the high seas. It's another installment of our series, Working. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials jumped 2.1% today, 189 points to close at 9,180. Believe it or not, that GDP figure better than expected. The NASDAQ drove up 2.5%, 41 points to finish at 1698. The S&P 500 pushed up that same 2.5%, only this time it was only worth 23 points to end at 954. Colgate-Palmolive squeezed out a 7% gain today after it reported good earnings. Ford jacked up 5.5% on news that it plans to add jobs at one factory. Home Depot ended nearly 5% higher. MGM Mirage hit the jackpot with another 11% gain as investors piled into gaming stocks. Airlines took off in the slipstream of news that Delta and Northwest have closed their merger. Delta and United both shot up about 19% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income, supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. More for Marketplace's special Fallout coverage, it's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events for Friday. The Commerce Department releases the September report on personal income and spending. The Labor Department releases the third quarter employment cost index. And it's Halloween. It was on Halloween Day in 1864 that the current battleground state of Nevada was admitted as the 36th state of the United States. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today might have brought us one step closer to the living room of the future. For our purposes, we're going to define that as being able to sit on your couch and watch almost anything you can think of without having to get up. The movie delivery service Netflix and TiVo, the original digital video recorder company, announced a deal today. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explains it's all about synergy and major advertising potential, too.
Consumers with TiVo's newest box and an internet connection will be able to download movies and shows from Netflix directly onto their TV at broadband speed. TiVo user Sharon Feibelkorn says she's sold.
Currently, if you want to get a movie through TiVo, I have to take out a phone cord, I have to stretch it across the living room, which just makes me crazy.
And probably a lot of other people, too, says brand strategist Jeff Gregory. He says unlike some previous attempts at marrying TV with internet, this one is fast and easy to use.
For someone who their VCR is still blinking 12-00, they're going to love to have something like this that's just plug and play.
Gregory says this is an important move for both companies, which have been struggling.
Both of them have been losing market share individually, but now you have product coupled with content.
And that could be advertising gold, says Josh Martin, an analyst with the Yankee Group. Netflix already has distribution deals with Xbox and internet-connected DVD players like Samsung and LG. Martin says Netflix is going to have a lot of valuable information.
If they're going to be on all these different devices, they're going to have a lot of insight on what people are watching, how they want to watch it, where they want to watch it.
TiVo has its own spate of deals, but Martin says its challenge will be to get consumers to go TiVo again.
It's just tough to sell a box for a couple $100 when your pay TV provider gives it to you for free.
The deal with Netflix may add an incentive. TiVo has just a couple million subscribers. Netflix has more than 8.5 million. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The European Union said this week it's going to send warships and airplanes to patrol off the coast of Somalia. Piracy has turned those waters near the Horn of Africa into some of the most dangerous in the world. Running a close second is the Strait of Malacca between Singapore and Indonesia. And that is where we go for the latest profile in our series, Working. The global economy is about more than just big companies and maximizing profit. Once you strip all that away, it's about a single person doing a job trying to get by, even if that job isn't always legal. Every year, something like 70,000 ships pass through the Strait of Malacca, about two-thirds of the world's sea traffic, which makes it what you might call a target-rich environment. Some pirates hijack entire boats for ransom. Others are just thieves who sneak on board to steal money, as Kelly McEvers tells us.
There's no soundtrack to Agus Laiote's life. Nothing swashbuckling about the way he slips his hands in his pockets and slouches when he walks into a hardware store.
How much for this machete?
If you were the shopkeeper, you might think Agus is a butcher or a fisherman. You'd have no idea it's his job to hold knives like this to the throats of ship captains and demand all their money. This knife costs about $10.
Okay.
Next stop is a rickety wooden house on stilts, the house of a local magician. Agus sets a bottle of water on the floor and asks the magician to bless it. He's talking to the water. He's shaking it. He's putting it under his arm. He's breathing into the water.
Camille?
The magician says if Agus wipes the magic water on his face, it will make him invisible to the Indonesian Navy.
Yeah.
He's already been questioned by the Navy once before, so Agus feels like he needs the extra protection. Agus says this is about all you need to be a pirate around here. Some crude weapons and a little magic. It's not like the movies. If it were like the movies, maybe Agus would like his job more. As it is, he says he's a pirate because he has no other choice. It's not a question of right or wrong for Agus. It's a question of survival.
I want to stop. It's dangerous out at sea. People have accidents. People die. I have a dream that one day I will make so much money I can quit this work and stop everything. But until then, what else can I do?
Agus grew up in a small Indonesian farming village more than 1,000 miles from here. He made $7 a day raising cocoa, but that barely fed his parents, siblings, wife, and three kids.
Then I met a man in my village who was successful. He owned a shop and his wife wore a lot of gold. I tried to stay close to him and ask him how he made so much money. After some time, he told me that he had been a pirate.
The man in the village told Agus to come here, to a small island in the Strait of Malacca, and start working as a boat taxi driver. That way, he would meet pirates.
So we are walking down the streets of the village where Agus lives. The sun has just gone down, and we are preparing for an operation.
Agus joined a pirate group about 4 years ago. Now he says he robs big international cargo ships about half a dozen times a year. The rest of the time, he robs houses.
And now we are walking out on the sidewalk on stilts. You can just see the silhouettes of little wooden boats on the water.
Agus says it's too dangerous to take me out with him to rob a ship. But he's promised to secretly record a future operation on his mobile phone.
What's this?
For now, he and the boys are showing me how it's done.
It's the knife?
Yeah.
The key, they say, is to go out on a night with little or no moon. That way, they can stay hidden from the Navy, which is out in full force these days. We climb into a low wooden canoe and head out toward the Strait of Malacca. This is one of the most heavily trafficked waterways in the world.
You can see the big ships over there, though. There is Singapore. I could swim to it.
We pull up to a light tower that's about 20 feet tall. That's less than half as high as a cargo ship would be. The plan is for Agus to climb the tower as if he were robbing it. The boys have fashioned a long bamboo stick.
And then you put a hook on the end of it. And then you throw the stick up at the boat and hook it on.
Dalam tujuh orang tadi ini, kita udah bagi bahwa kamu jaga orang.
We do it in a team of seven. We climb up the bamboo pole to the ship. Two of us go to the bridge to catch the captain. The others stay and guard the crew. Sometimes the captain fights back, so we have to hit him and tie him up with rope. Then we tell him to give us all the money in the safe.
Agus says he only hits captains, but one Navy officer told me pirates sometimes cut off captains' hands if they don't cooperate. If Agus and his partners manage to steal the money from the safe, each one can clear about $600 or $700.
Sometimes we fail and come home with no money, but we still have to pay for the fuel, so we end up in debt.
The next day, Agus shows us the two rooms he rents for about $20 a month.
And there's no furniture in here. And then in the other room, there's just a mattress on the floor and a fan, a little pink oscillating fan. The mosque is right across the street.
Agus was raised a Muslim, but he doesn't pray very much these days. He says he feels guilty that he doesn't always have enough money to send home, and that his wife is left to support the family.
Now my wife has managed to work for herself and make good money as a nurse.
Back in the village, this only brings Agus more shame.
But I'm still doing this bad job and not making much money. For this reason, I feel ashamed. I cannot go back home with nothing, so I have to stay here.
When Agus does make money, he doesn't always save it for the family. That's because after a successful operation, it's a tradition for pirates to celebrate with what they call happy happy, or booze and girls. This night, it's Agus's friend who's celebrating. He's just made a couple hundred bucks stealing crude from an oil tanker and reselling it. Tonight, the happy happy is a case of beer and a troupe of disco girls who travel from island to island and charge men to dance with them.
That's your girl. That's
her?
Your girlfriend, right?
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, okay. That's my girlfriend, the tall one. Her name is Yuna.
Yeah.
Pretty soon, Agus has spent his last $5 to be with Yuna. He doesn't touch her. He just closes his eyes, throws his head back, and dances and dances. In the 3 days that I've known him, it's the first time I've seen Agus smile a real smile. I wave goodbye and take my final boat taxi away from the island. Since that night, Agus says he's been on two pirate operations. One was a success. He made nearly $1,000, a huge amount of money in Indonesia. The other was not. Too many Navy boats out that night. I called Agus a few times and asked about the recording he said he'd make on his mobile phone. He kept promising to do it. The last time I talked to him, though, he admitted he had to pawn the phone. Because, he said, he was broke. Again.
Kelly McEvers went to Indonesia to get that story for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. You can see pictures of Agus and find out how we found him. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes today. First, a lesson in how the numbers don't always tell the whole story. ExxonMobil reported third quarter profits today. What do you know? Broke its own record for most money made by a single company in the entire history of companies on this planet, $14.8 billion. That is profit, free and clear. Exxon was helped along in large part by record oil prices back in July. It's a good guess the company will clear more than a couple of billion dollars next quarter, too, but maybe not quite as much. Crude closed at $65.96 a barrel today. Also, there is more political oomph now behind some kind of relief for Detroit. Today, Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm and governors from five other states called on Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke to work their bailout magic on carmakers and to do it sooner rather than later, too. It is later now for us. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow rose 189 points, 2.1%. NASDAQ added 41 points, 2.5%. The S&P 500 gained 23 points, also 2.5%. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, newly minted MBAs eye the rocky economy.
I think in a good year and a good market, everyone assumes they'll get a job. Today, there's more probing on this front.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.